When the leaves have been stripped from the trees, the world looks different, and sometimes we get to see amazing things that have been hidden, like the nests of bald-faced hornets. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here, and we'll talk about hornets' nests. Also, our frigid world is suddenly insect-free, but as soon as spring arrives, insects will return. We'll talk about how insects survive the winter and how they show up so quickly when the warmth returns. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in a few minutes to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start in the insect world, which is a very quiet place in Iowa right now, with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Good morning, Donald.
A cold good morning to you, Charity.
Yes, 12 degrees for my morning walk with the dogs this morning.
Wow.
And not a lot of insect activity out there today.
No, insects are cold-blooded, and their body temperature is the same as the environment around them. And so on a hot, sunny day, an insect setting in the sunshine has a really high body temperature. And on cold days like this, the insects have very low body temperatures, which, of course, is the opposite of what we do. We spend a lot of energy to keep a constant body temperature, whereas insects don't fight that fight. They just let their body temperature rise and fall with the environmental temperature, realizing that we are able to continue to function at 12 above zero because of our warm body temperature. At this temperature, the insects have hunkered down. They're just waiting for the warmth to return.
And we will talk about some of the ways that they do survive the winter in just a few minutes. But let's start by talking about one of the things that is left behind from a very busy insect summer in Iowa. When all the leaves are gone and everything is bare out there, you can see things that you can't see in the summertime. And among those things are the nests of bald-faced hornets. What do they look like so we know what we're seeing?
Well, they look like a round ball, anywhere from maybe soccer ball size up to, maybe a bigger than a basketball, maybe a little smaller than a half bushel basket. But it's a spherical structure, usually sort of oblong. It's not going to be a perfectly round sphere, but it's an oblong structure that's hanging in the tree, and you sort of recognize it by its silhouette. Frequently, they'll be out near the end of the branch, and it has been there. That nest that you're seeing now that the leaves are gone has been there since May. It grew gradually over the summer and got bigger and bigger. But as the leaves fall, what was camouflaged and concealed in the tree foliage is now plainly visible. Usually above your head, on up to the top of the tree. They can be quite high in the tree. More often in this 15, 20 foot off the ground range. So we're looking for something hanging in the tree. Not everybody's going to get to see them. I don't think there's a lot of them in the state of Iowa. And I think it's like woolly bears crossing the road in the fall. Some people notice them. And my wife keeps saying, "How did you know that was a woolly bear?" And other people don't notice woolly bears crossing the road. When the leaves are falling, my eyes are looking at the trees to see how many bald-faced hornet nests are out there, and I've got my eye on one now.
And these nests are only used for one season?
They are annual colonies, sort of like our bumblebees, where it starts with a single female in the spring who begins to make a nest. And in the case of the bald-faced hornet, it's similar to paper wasps and yellow jackets in that the females take wood fiber that they chew from dead posts or dead tree limbs, and they masticate that. They chew it up. They mix it with wasp spit, and they press out a paper mache material with their mouth parts. And so the envelope that surrounds their nest is this grayish paper mache that they have been making. And in a very small one of those that may have been no bigger than a tennis ball at the beginning, The single queen begins to lay eggs and feed chopped up insect bits to her offspring. And once she has a new generation of daughters, they begin working for her, and it snowballs from there. And what started with a single queen in the spring reaches a maximum of maybe 500 individuals in the fall of the year. They produce new queens who go out and hibernate through the winter, and the old nest, the old queen, the old workers will all disintegrate and perish.
If I crack one of those nests open, what do I see?
Inside are layers of paper comb, and the comb is what you would sort of expect to see if you looked inside a honeybee hive. If you think about, okay, I've got these rows and layers of cells, and inside the cells there are little larvae, or that's where the larvae were when they were growing. Another way to think of it is if you stand on the ground and look under the peak of the eave of your house, frequently you'll see this little nest hanging upside down by a little stem. It looks like an upside down umbrella. That's the nest of the paper wasp. That same nest structure is what's inside the bald-faced hornet nest, only just layer after layer after layer of them, all enveloped in this paper mache.
And you said you have your eye on one of these right now. You think these make wonderful decorations.
Well, it's a challenge to see them. It's fun to find them. It's fun to remind you of architecture that insects can produce. I mean, here's a silly little insect with nothing more than mouth parts for chewing up wood fiber that it can mix with wasp spit and press out a structure that will shelter and protect and enclose them for the entire duration that it's needed. So it's sort of this fun story to think about that, really, an insect made that? That is just so cool. But then when the insect doesn't need it, it breaks down, it decomposes, it disintegrates, and the materials are recycled in nature. Yes, I maxed out. I have three of these hanging in my office, and I think that's about enough for one person to have. So now any that I collect, I give away to friends, and they make great conversation pieces, and I think every office, every home should have one.
Do you have to do anything to preserve one if you gather it?
Not a bit. You just have to leave it alone. If you hang it up out of reach so that it doesn't get beat up, it doesn't get banged around, it doesn't get broken, they last for decades. And in fact, the oldest one that I have in my office was collected in 1993. And it has been hanging there unmolested, undisturbed, and it looks the same as it did when I brought it in. Okay, it's got a little dust on top, but the paper mache is still there. They don't have to be varnished. They don't have to be shellacked. They don't have to be covered with hairspray. They just have to be left alone. Now, if you put it on the table and people pick it up and you move it and you bump it, it will break up. It's fairly fragile. So the preservation technique is to hang it up and leave it alone.
And how do you hang it?
Well, the bald-faced hornet nest is attached to a tree branch that out on the end of the branch, they hung their nest. And eventually, as they enlarge this nest, remember it started at the size of a tennis ball and now it's the size of a basketball. As they enlarged it, it sort of encompassed the branch and the twigs and the leaves around it. So it's attached to a limb. And what you do when you're taking one of these down is you carefully consider how much stick you want to take with it. And so you back up from the bald-faced hornet nest, a foot, 2 foot, 3 foot. And that's where you saw it off, hoping you do a nice job of pruning for that particular tree. And you carefully lower it to the ground or drop it to the ground and catch it or take it down with you on the ladder. So you have the stick that it's attached to. And then by carefully positioning some fishing line off of the light fixtures in your office, you can hang this in the corner so that it looks like the stick is growing diagonally across your office wall, and here's the bald-faced hornet nest hanging from the stick.
And how high are they usually from the ground? How do you get them?
If they're too high, you're just out of luck.
Okay.
I don't have a bucket truck, but if you had a bucket truck, that's how
maybe
you would do
Christmas
it.
Maybe for Christmas this year.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think so. I have stood on a stepladder and used a pruning pole. So if you think about, okay, I was 6 feet off the ground with a stepladder and I was holding my 15-foot pruning pole as high as I could reach, you know, we were up there 20 feet and I was sawing away on the branch and the people around me were waiting to catch it as it fell. And fortunately for that one, we were successful in catching it and not letting it smash against the ground. It's a job, and there's no easy way to do it. You just have to be able to get to it either with your pruning pole or with your pruning saw. Please do it safely and to get it down from where it hangs.
So you mentioned earlier that all of this generation of hornets that lived in that nest, were born in that nest, worked in that nest, almost all of them are gone now. But there is a queen that is left behind, right?
At the end of the summer, the colony, which is now the old queen and a whole lot of her daughters, hundreds of her daughters, they produce new queens. And these are females who will be sexually reproductive in the following year. And the colony produces a handful of males. Those males and the new queens depart the nest and they fly around the county, which is kind of a good thing because they leave home, the males leave first, the males disperse around the county, and they find the females from other nests. Once a female is mated, once the new queen is mated, she has the ability to hibernate and survive the cold winter, no matter how cold it gets. The new queen is dead. Her workers have frozen to death. The males have frozen to death. The nest is disintegrated. The perpetuation of the species is invested in that new queen who has to make it through the winter, start from scratch next year, and do it all over again.
And do we know where she chooses to hibernate?
Somewhere protected, in out of the wind, in out of the cold. She's probably in a brush pile. She could be under the loose bark of a dead tree. She could be in your firewood stack. She may have sort of crawled to the bottom of a tuft of tall grass. Somewhere protected, somewhere where she won't go through great expansions and contractions in temperature. She's not going to be really hot, followed by really cold. So she's in someplace protected where it's going to stay steady. The temperature will stay steady, and she will hunker down and wait for spring.
And when spring comes, does she have to build that entire shell all by herself?
She starts it, and she makes enough nests to enclose just a dozen or so cells, and she'll lay the first dozen eggs, and she will go out and gather the food to feed her offspring. Once those reach maturity, once that first brood of offspring reach maturity, they take over the work of gathering the food, gathering the wood fiber, making the papier mache, expanding the nest, and the queen goes back to laying eggs for the rest of her life.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Coming up in just a moment, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will join the program, and they are here to answer your questions. Call us, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects today. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran is here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today, and we'll get right to some questions. This is from Sue in Ames. I have two top hat blueberry plants in containers. What should be done with them for the winter? This is their first season. Should they be brought in? If so, what conditions and temperatures?
Basically, I think she has two options. One is to put them in a cool location, maybe a unheated garage or a cool porch where it stays nice and cool but doesn't get as cold as outside, and leave them there. The other option would be if it does thaw out, maybe later on this month, and the ground thaws out, to dig maybe a hole in the ground and set the pot in the ground and then place soil back around the pot so that it insulates that plant. And so that would be the other option.
I was so happy that I spent a long time on Sunday afternoon finishing putting
so
in all
I.
of my bulbs. It was quite the victory.
And getting the leaves away from the front door. It was a busy
and
day
mowing,
on Sunday.
Yes. Yeah. Cleaning the gutters, yes.
And I keep looking at the extended forecast for that next 50-degree day, and I'm not seeing it.
I don't either. Maybe next weekend, maybe 40s, they say.
Maybe. Although the ground will be so hard. All right, let's get to some questions. This is Suzanne in Grinnell. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I just wanted to know what June bugs' purpose in life is and why they exist, and do they do harm? Do they do good? I think I've seen them in the soil other times besides when they're flying around. But, you know, could you help me?
Let me clarify. Did you say June bug?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So hard-shelled beetles that are sort of mahogany in color.
Yeah, and run around just sort of propelling themselves into random objects.
Right. Attracted to lights and so forth. Well, June bug is one of the scarab beetles, which means we've narrowed it down to one of about 30,000 different things we could be talking about here when you say June bug. June bugs divide themselves into two different groups, but when we use the word June bug, we're usually talking about plant-feeding beetles, and they spend their larval stage, their immature stage, is frequently a grub in the ground where they feed on grass roots and organic matter. Then they come out in the adult stage, and the purpose of the adult stage is for reproduction. So males and females find each other, they mate, the female lays eggs, and they start the cycle over. Some of our June bugs have a life cycle of 2 or 3 years, that it takes 3 years to go from egg to adult to start the process over. Many of them have a 1 year life cycle. They go from egg to an adult in 1 year. Purpose is an interesting question. That implies that everything has to have some reason for existence, and I think lots of insects just are. We could say that in an ecosystem, June bugs are recyclers, that they are converting organic matter into nutrients that can be used by other plants. So they do have that niche in the ecosystem. I mentioned there were two groups of June bugs. The others that you probably don't want to talk about on a day this close to lunch would be the dung beetles. Those are the insects that roll up balls of dung. They lay their eggs in there, and then their offspring find enough nutrition in the manure of other animals to actually grow and make a new animal. But, you know, recycling is probably, if you had to think of them in an ecological sense, that's how I would try to sum it up.
Well, and I know some juvenile foxes and even some cats, maybe some puppies that think they're delicious.
They could be edible. In fact, if you were hard up and really, really hungry, you could probably saute them with a little butter and garlic, and maybe they would taste like shrimp. But
well, when fox eat them, it sounds like popcorn, so...
Oh, yeah.
It's very appealing.
Uh-huh. So a role in, you know, what are they doing out there for us? Not much. In fact, some of them are pests. But what are they doing for the ecosystem? A little bit of recycling of nutrients and a link in the food chain.
All right, Suzanne, thank you very much for your call. And next up, Don is on the line in Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hi, Don.
Hello, yes.
And you, you're also a bald-faced hornet enthusiast, at least you were.
Yes, I am. My first experience with them was when I was in kindergarten, would have been about 1954, and my father and I were out in the woods, and he spotted this large hornet's nest up in the tree in range, and he went back and got a saw. We sawed the thing limb off and took it home. Well, actually, we left it out, I think, in the back of the truck. But my show-and-tell time, the open house for the parents was coming up at kindergarten, so I thought, this is a good thing to take to school.
You bet.
Well, it was great. You know, we got it in there. It was pretty cold outside. Well, about the time people started arriving for the open house, all of a sudden the hornets had warmed up and were starting to fly around the room. Inside the school, which caused quite a bit of consternation to the class, of course. But the teacher was real cool. She got out a box of Kleenex and stuffed it in the hole and plugged it up. And later then, after that evening, I took it home and it was put into a large bag and then fumigated with Raid. Yeah. Ended up killing them all. So I guess my question was, how long they would really live in there. It was definitely below freezing at that point. But and the other question, another thing I noticed was I'd seen one I'd liked, really wanted to collect, and I saw it up in the tree a few years ago. And by the time I got back there, apparently the birds must get in there and eat the larvae or the bees because it was totally shredded, I think, from birds going at it.
There are a lot of things that will tear into them. Kids with balls will try to knock them down and so forth. And, yes, I think other animals are curious what that is, and maybe they get hungry enough to look what's in there. Well, it's not a... it's not a sudden death for all the bald-faced hornets that are in there. And by now that we've had a good week of freezing, they're probably dead. But I would
say... Suddenly I'm trusting you less and less after listening to Don's story.
Yeah. Well, you can collect these.
Right now I want to collect, so I'll let it go. Maybe it'd be cold enough now then.
It'll be cold enough, and
okay. The
other thing is, if they froze in there, there will be the hint of the aroma of dead animal from the dead hornets that are in there. So when people collect these, I frequently say, okay, why don't you leave it in your garage for a while? And that way we make sure we're through this period where all of the hornets have died and they have desiccated enough, dehydrated enough that there's no longer any smell to it. But you can collect them in the summer. You can go up there at night with your garbage bag and slip that over, and you can cut the branch off in the middle of the summer to get one to make sure nobody has bothered it or nothing has gone up there and destroyed it. And in that case, you do have to take care of the living hornets and the larvae inside before you can put it up for display.
I think I'll just wait.
Yeah, I'd wait till fall.
Yeah.
There's a big collection of them, actually. There's a little... bar restaurant right by the river in Marquette, and there must be years ago I was there. There were probably a dozen nests hanging up in the restaurant. So people swing by there, they can see a good selection, all different sizes.
It's good to know.
Anyway, thank you.
All right, Don, thanks a lot for your call. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Barbara. Can you wrap burlap directly around a small Alberta spruce tree without supporting the burlap with hardware cloth?
Yes, you could. Yes.
Okay. And this is a question from Diane in Vinton. What is the status on the invasive marmorated brown stink bug?
Well, brown marmorated stink bug is still located in isolated spots around the state of Iowa. I think it's 12 counties that have sent us specimens to confirm that they have it, but those counties extend from all the way from Council Bluffs to Davenport and lots of places in between. So it may be statewide, but it's not everywhere statewide. So it's in these isolated locations. It is still only a household problem. That's the only way we notice it is in October on a sunny day. They'll be on the south side of the house hanging out with the box elder bugs and the multicolored Asian lady beetles. So a few people saw them this year, but by and large, we did not expand the known distribution this year.
All right. Here's a question from Val. In his recent book, Keeping the Bees, Lawrence Packer recommends that gardeners do not use mulch because of the negative impact on ground burrowing bees. Do we have ground burrowing bees in Iowa? And what do you think about the recommendation?
Oh, I think that's trying to make too much out of a little piece of information. But yes, we do have ground burrowing bees. We call them digger bees. We call them mining bees. We call them sweat bees. The study we've done over the last several years in organic vegetable farms found as many as 53 different species of small bees, and the small bees that are not honeybees, the small bees are primarily these ground nesting bees. Some of them nest in cavities of stems and so forth. And one of the ways we can do that is to not, one of the ways we can protect those other solitary pollinators is to not till as much. Now, if you're talking about mulch that's under the junipers next to your foundation, the bees aren't going to be there anyway. But if you have a garden area, if you have a vegetable patch, leaving that ground bare might be an advantage to the solitary bees. So I don't think it's as easy as to say mulch is bad for bees, because it's so highly variable on where you put the mulch and what it's under.
All right. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. And here's a question from Joe in Cedar Falls. Is it okay to prune lower white pine branches on a fairly large pine? They're up to 6 or 7 inches in diameter and up to 6 feet off the ground. They're starting to invade my garden space.
You can. It's not going to kill the tree, but you're not doing that for the benefit of the tree. You're doing it for the benefit of the garden. So, but you can do it. Just make a nice clean cut.
All right. And no concerns about time at this point? Is it
not
cold
really
enough and
not
everything's
really
okay?
You can almost do that any time of the year.
All right. You can join the conversation. We've got a couple lines open for you right now, 866-780-9100. And Donald, I want to get back to talking about how insects survive the winter, because as soon as the sun shines in the spring, we do see insects emerging. But not all insects leave someone behind to hibernate, right?
All insects that we have through the summer had to make it through the winter. They have to make it through an inhospitable period somewhere, somehow. And some insects are, especially our native northern insects, they all have a stage and a capability to make it through the winter. Now, the other part of this is we tend to think everything happens to everybody the same. And with insects, most of them won't make it. There'll be a very high mortality through inhospitable periods, whether it's drought or flood or cold or too hot. Not all of them are going to make it, but insects have this high reproductive capacity, lots of offspring per female, so that they can recover with the few that do make it. Now, in Iowa insects, some of them burrow into the soil, they hunker down, they hibernate, they stay cold.
And what are some of the other species, other than bald-faced hornets, that have an adult that actually hibernates through the winter?
Many of the bumblebees would make it through the winter that same way. There would be an adult female that comes out in the fall of the year and makes it through the year. There's only about one or two butterflies that commonly make it in the adult stage. More often, they wait as an immature and finish their development in the springtime. But the bumblebees are ones that would have that same life cycle of a queen, of a female, waiting for the coming year. And they have to be able to hibernate, they have to be able to survive, and they have to be able to do that without ice forming in their cells. And to do that, they contain a material that's similar to antifreeze. And that allows them to, that allows their body to go below the temperature of freezing down to minus 20, minus 25, those days we get in the middle of the winter. And yet ice doesn't form inside their body because of the antifreeze-like material.
And then some insects will lay eggs that will stay through the wintertime and then hatch in the spring?
The worst of our mosquitoes is an example of where they laid eggs at the edge of the water last year, and those eggs are going to hibernate. Those eggs are going to stay cold. They're going to stay unhatched until next spring when the floodwaters rise. When those eggs are warm and submerged again, those eggs will hatch and development will continue as if there hadn't been this multi-month interruption in the development cycle. So yes, some insects overwinter as eggs, some overwinter as caterpillars and pupae, and some as cocoons. The black swallowtail, that the larva that you saw on your dill and on your parsley this year, went into the cocoon or the pupal stage, into the chrysalis, since it's a butterfly, went into the chrysalis stage, and it's going to wait in that stage for warmer temperature to finish the development next spring.
And I know last winter we asked you a lot of times, because everybody kept on asking, is this horrible, horrible winter going to kill off all of the insects that we don't want to have around? And there were some insect populations that were significantly smaller this summer.
That's right. Yes to kill, no to all.
Okay.
That's the point, that yes, the cold winter could have been a significant mortality factor to insect populations, but these things are survivors. They are adapted to this climate. They're going to make it. One that was noticeably absent this year was the Japanese beetle, and that could have been because of the double whammy. They had a dry fall, which would have been a stressful factor. So if they were unhealthy going into winter, and then it froze harder, deeper, longer than usual, that extra stress could have been the reason we had so few of them this year. So in that case, it's the larval stage. It's the immature that's trying to hibernate underground, make it through the winter. And last year, apparently a significant portion of them didn't, but some did.
And the fact that there weren't that many this summer, is that an indication for how the population might be next summer?
Friends of mine back east talk about these periodic disappearances of the Japanese beetles, but they never really disappear. They're just below the radar for a while. And over a period of years, they can recover and you will get outbreaks again. It's not going to be instantaneous. They will be there, and when conditions are right, they will explode on us again.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, and then we'll take your calls at 866-780-9100. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa, and we're taking your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, and Evie is on the line from Fairfield. Hi, Evie.
Hi. Hey, is it too late to trim my mature lilac bush? I have a big old lilac bush.
Yeah, I probably would wait and do that around March, early April. And if it's a huge plant, what you might want to do is go out there at that time and maybe select three or four of the biggest, largest ones and cut them down near the ground and get rid of them. Now, you're going to have fewer blooms that spring, but if it's a real old plant, that's a good way to rejuvenate the plant or shrub.
Okay, yeah, I think, I don't know that it has a whole bunch of, it seems like it comes from one brand, one big trunk, or it doesn't. Or maybe I just, you know, it doesn't seem like it's,
okay,
like it's a bunch of separate branches coming up from the ground.
Yeah, check it. Most lilacs are multi-stemmed shrubs, and some of those can get to be tree-like in size, but look, and if there are multiple stems, then maybe take out a few of the big ones.
It's regular lilac and not Japanese tree lilac?
It's a regular lilac.
Regular
it's
lilac?
A bush. It's a bush. It's not a tree. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All
okay.
right.
Okay, and it's not too late. If it warms up again, can I put in bulbs?
If it warms up and you can get them in the ground, you're okay.
Okay.
Good luck.
Cross your fingers.
Okay. Take your pickaxe.
Right.
Much, yeah. Everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Mike is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I just had something I wanted to share with the group there. And this year we actually had encountered two of the bald-faced hornet's nests, one at our grandparents' home, which was surprising. It was the size of about a beach ball. And then we just noticed here this fall that our maple tree next to the patio had a bald-faced hornet's nest as well, and it was about the size of a football. But we were surprised, I guess. We spend so much time outdoors grilling at the patio that we weren't bothered by the hornets, and I was just kind of curious why that might be. And I'll take your response off the air here.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call.
Mike's exactly right that these things go, the bald-faced hornets are in the tree, they're making that nest, they're gathering food, they're raising offspring, they're doing that all summer. and we don't even notice it. Now, some people notice that they collect wood fibers off the railings of their porch and stuff like that, but we can be quite close to these nests and never know they are there because we're not a food source for them, we're not a threat for them, they have no interest in us. They're too busy doing what they have to do to perpetuate the species that they leave us alone until you get too close, you start to irritate them, you somehow threaten them. Mike's experience having one in his backyard is similar to my experience. One of the ones that I have hanging in my office, I collected on campus. I collected it from a crabapple tree, and it was directly above and dead center on a sidewalk where hundreds of students and undergraduates and graduate students walk by every day, and they were walking under this thing, and no one reported it. No one knew it was there until the leaves fell. And it had been hanging there all summer, all fall, and no one saw it, no one noticed it. So they hide very well behind the leaves until the leaves are gone.
And we do now know that one of the things that makes them feel threatened is if you take them into a kindergarten classroom.
Well, yes, if you cut them down and move them around and shake them up, yeah, that can happen. Don had that unfortunate experience there in Iowa City in his kindergarten room. But yeah, you want to make sure it's been frozen for a while before you take it back in and warm it up.
All right, Bill's on the line next in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what would you like to talk about today?
Good. A question for Donald. I have found these bald-faced hornets in southern Iowa, specifically in Clark and Decatur counties. I live in west central Iowa in Sac City, and I do hike in the timbered areas frequently. Are they limited in their range, or am I simply not adequately observant when I'm walking in my home area?
Oh, I think you're plenty observant. Your observation matches mine. They are statewide. They are through it's kind of the eastern 3/8 of the United States, I guess. So they could be everywhere. But it seems to be natural wooded areas where we find them the most abundant. And I think of going to Dolliver State Park and seeing one hanging there, but not seeing one in the fence rows and along the cornfields between Ames and Fort Dodge. So I think there's some ecosystem requirement there that they tend to be more abundant where there's more woodlands and not out so much in the open. So the urban forest makes a great place for them. State parks and southern Iowa with their rolling hillsides covered with trees make great places for them. I think it's just a little harder for them to survive in Sac County than it is down in Clark County.
Good. Thank you.
All right, Bill. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Gabby in Cedar Falls. Hi, Gabby.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, after that horrible drought, I lost 12 arborvitae trees and with poor forethought decided to replace them. And last winter was kind of rough on them. They came out of the winter looking really stressed. And so we nursed them along all summer and made sure that they got the water they needed and stuff. But I was just wondering, is there anything I can do to kind of help them through the winter a little bit more? They're 4-foot trees, and I just would hate to replace them again.
Yeah, we had ample moisture this growing season, so in that regard, they're in good shape. The one thing would be if they're in a very open, exposed site, possibly, if you can, putting in a screen to their west or north, keeping off the sun and wind, that tends to dry them out. You could do that, and that might be beneficial.
Yes, because they're very exposed to the north.
Okay, so you could try that where you pound in some wooden stakes. You take your burlap, you stretch it between the stakes, use a staple gun and basically staple it to the stakes, and you have that burlap screen that deflects the wind.
So you put up a windbreak for your windbreak?
Well, kind of.
Eventually, there's supposed to be a windbreak, but yeah, exactly.
But when they're young trees,
right?
Their root system isn't quite as extensive, and so if you're going to get damage, it's more likely the first year or two, as far as that first winter or two.
Right.
Once they get established, they're much better able to handle it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for that answer. And then just one follow-up question to your Japanese beetle conversation. Japanese beetles are the bane of my existence, so I was really happy to see them gone last summer. But I was wondering what your opinion is on using systemic for trees, because I hear that it kind of changes the taste of the leaves, and then they maybe don't like my trees as much. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer on that.
That's a tough question, and in the 12 minutes left, we may not do it quite justice, and this may require
we're going to spend the whole 12 minutes?
Oh, no, no. Well, I'll cut it short, Charity.
Right.
I see you tapping your toe at me. Hurry up, Donald, hurry up. There are insecticides that we can put into trees and non-food-bearing shrubs to control insects that eat the foliage. And in the case of linden trees that used to strip our Japanese beetles, that was an option. However, we now know that the insecticide that we put into the roots to go up and into the leaves is also going into the flowers and into the nectar and pollen, where it may, emphasize, may have an adverse effect on pollinators. So we're leery of treating trees carte blanche and just doing all of them because we want to. We're really leery of using these systemics for Japanese beetle control where there are also lots of pollinators. Now, a systemic on your rose probably won't affect pollinators if it's a hybrid tea rose because we don't get a lot of pollinators on those flowers. So if there are pollinators going to visit the flowers of the tree or shrub you're treating, we would ask you to think twice about it.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Next up, we have Steve in North Central Iowa. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I was wondering if we could get some information off those earwake bugs, I think that's what they're called, and how you could possibly get rid of them in the house.
You have earwigs in the house. Earwigs are...
like in the basement, coming into the the entranceway and stuff like that.
Okay,
yeah.
But only in the summer, right?
Yeah.
You don't have them now?
No.
Okay, yeah. Okay, earwigs are about 3/4 inch long. They're fairly brown. The distinctive characteristic is they have pinchers on the tail end, and when they are running, they hold their pinchers upright, perpendicular to the ground, and then as they run, they wiggle. And that's where the wig in earwig comes from. It's because they're wiggling as they run. The earwigs live outdoors. I don't think you could raise them inside because they require a damp environment where they can feed on various kinds of organic matter. And the ones you're getting inside are accidental invaders. They tend to vary greatly from year to year and from place to place, and maybe you won't have them again. Maybe they'll be back at some point in the future. Sealing up cracks and gaps would be our first suggestion, but of course that's easier said than done. If there are damp locations like mulch or potted plants or something that's holding moisture against the ground right next to the door, maybe we could move that away. The last resort would be to spray with insecticide, but spraying the top of mulch is not going to have any effect. We're going to have to pull the mulch aside, spray the ground underneath, put the mulch back, somehow dry up the area where the earwigs are reproducing on the outside of the house.
Does that help you out, Steve? All right. And, you know, borrowing neighbor chickens, again, to return to my cure-all for every insect invasion. But
get those chickens. Uh-huh. What do you do when the chickens become invasive, though?
Well, that's why I said borrow them.
Borrow some neighborhood
chickens, and then you can give them right back.
And then when you've got too many chickens, you have to borrow the other neighbor's fox.
All right. Next up, Eddie's on the line in North Liberty. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, this is New Liberty, not North Liberty.
Oh, New Liberty, pardon me. All right, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a chestnut grove, 68 chestnut trees.
Wow.
Over the winter, I lost 5 of them that never leafed out, and I have about 7 to 10 that's leaf partial. I was wondering if there's anything I could do to the ones that only leaf partial to help save them. They were planted in 95.
Okay. When you say partial, like 75% or 50%?
The leaves is only about 35%.
Ooh, not very good. There's really not much you can do at this point. I'm assuming what may have damaged them was basically environmental as far as the weather. We had 2 very dry summers in a row, and then we had last winter where we had extreme cold, especially very cold soil temperatures, which may have damaged the roots and caused the damage. Nothing at this point. You can maybe fertilize them next spring a little bit, You could use like a 10, 10, 10 and just sprinkle that around the trees. If we have a very dry summer next year, if possible, watering the trees so they have moisture, trying to provide ideal growing conditions for the trees, basically.
Okay.
It's called tender loving care.
Yes. Well, and hope for favorable weather, yes.
Yeah, it's quite a surprise. I had 1,600 pounds of the chestnuts last year, and this year I had 320.
Oh, bummer.
Wow.
Wow. Well, Eddie, thanks a lot for your call. I hope next season is better for you.
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Next up, Corey's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Corey.
Hi, love the show, guys.
Thanks. What's your question?
I got a question. Last year I was mowing my backyard. I was wearing shorts. I know I shouldn't have been wearing shorts, but I got stung in the leg by something. So needless to say, I stopped mowing, took off, looked at my leg, just saw a little mark, went back to mowing. And the only reason I saw it was because it came back and stung me again in pretty much the same spot.
Uh-huh.
From what I saw, its rear end was either black with white stripes or white with black stripes.
Uh-huh.
And it was almost, I would say, probably the size of a bumblebee. Do you guys know what that might have been?
Well, could have been a bumblebee. Those,
okay.
They're out there in the yard, and they nest in the ground. They're kind of common in our landscape. They nest in retaining walls and wood piles and so forth. White and black, unfortunately, does describe the bald-faced hornet, but that doesn't really fit there. The other one, though, that really comes to mind that is fairly aggressive and is a good stinger is the yellow jacket wasp. And the stripes are black and yellow, sometimes bright, vividly yellow, sometimes kind of a faded, pale yellow. But they nest in the ground, and they're fairly aggressive in the fall of the year, that the lawnmower must vibrate the ground or something, and they will come out and investigate. They will defend from what they feel is a threat to them, your lawnmower or you. I'm going to guess, just based on probability, it's either the bald-faced hornet it's either the bumblebee or this yellow jacket wasp.
All right, Corey, thanks a lot for your call. And one more call. Bob is on the line in Tipton. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a cherry tree in my backyard that's about 15 feet away from the oak tree, and it's starting to grow more to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to trim some of them larger limbs to keep it try to grow straight up. When would be the best time to prune those?
The best time would be late winter, early spring, basically March, early April, before the tree begins to leaf out.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Bob. And here's a question from Matt. I just planted a maple tree last week. With these temperatures, when should I stop watering?
Well, if the ground stays frozen, you can't do any more watering at this point. But most likely at some point the ground may thaw out. And if it does thaw out and the ground is starting to dry out, then go ahead and water. So that could be November, December, possibly. And if we have a prolonged mild period in January, possibly, too.
But if you're watering and it's just turning into a frozen puddle on the ground, that's probably not doing it much good.
If the ground is frozen, it does no good. No.
And be sure to get that mulch over the root ball.
Right. And maybe also getting your hose put away is a good idea at this point.
Yes.
Hopefully you did that on Sunday.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for your time today, gentlemen.
Thank you, Charity.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday. And with me in the studio now, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, on the air at noon today. What's coming up, Ben?
Hi, Charity. We'll talk about a new landmark study indicating that pesticides may be causing depression in farmers. We'll ask which pesticides that may be. Also, the inventor or the man who successfully campaigned for the Farmer Wave. Did you know it's Farmer Wave Week?
I did.
Do you know what a farmer wave is?
I practice the farmer wave every day.
Now there are a lot of people who don't know what it is. They'll have to tune in over the noon hour,
Absolutely.
Charity.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks a lot. River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.